Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Kanzer, and I'm joined today by a globetrotting comics journalist. He's the author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. He's also a contributing editor at The Nib, and he teaches cartooning at Stanford University and the Animation Workshop in Denmark. Andy Warner, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I introduced you as a globe-trotting comics artist, but you've been moving from place to place, country to country, long before you were making any of your own decisions about your career or even your schooling.
That's true. So I was born in Southern California, in Santa Barbara, but my dad is a marine biologist who studies, or studied, he's retired now, sex-changing fish. And so his research brought us really all over the world. Before I was around, they had been living and working at a field station in San Blas, Panama, and Guanayala, this indigenous autonomous territory, part of Panama. And we lived there when I was young on a very small island called the Smithsonian Research Center. We moved around to Japan, to Corsica, to St. Croix. We spent a year of his sabbatical in Oxford, England. And, you know, in a lot of these places, my mom would be doing different things. Sometimes she worked as a research assistant for people doing PhDs in Guanayala. She worked as a scientific illustrator of fish. She was also doing a thesis of her own when we were living in France. We really moved around a lot when I was a kid. And not only me, but, you know, generationally as well. Like, my mother also grew up in Trinidad. She grew up in Mexico, even though her family is from Connecticut. And so it was always sort of formed a part of my upbringing and my adult life too.
Well, your book, Spring Rain, is based on your own experiences traveling to Lebanon in 2005 to study Arab literature at the American University of Beirut. At the time, Lebanon was enjoying a period of peace and stability after years of civil unrest and invasions from Syria and Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a brief period. Israel had only pulled out across the southern border 5 years before, and the Lebanese state has never been strong in the wake of the civil war since the Taif Accords ended the civil war in the early 90s and kind of established the modern sectarian Lebanese state. The state's always been pretty weak, and there's always been these kind of flare-ups of unrest in the country, kind of directed towards this ruling class that has had their grip on the country basically since the end of the civil war, this kind of coalition of warlords and plutocrats and their children and nephews and stuff like that. But the time that I was there in 2005, like, a lot of people were talking about this, you know, Lebanon on the rise. Like, it had been a few years since there had been anything that had really happened there. It's always been this huge regional hub, whether it's enduring war, unrest, or peace, for journalists, for business, for education. So with 5 years of relative stability under its belt, Beirut was really seen from the outside and especially from the inside as being on the rise. And then about a month after I arrived there, it was rocked by this enormous explosion. Up until last month, the largest explosion, which assassinated the former Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri, who was on the verge of running and attempting to get power again.
Yeah, it might surprise some people to know that back in the mid-20th century, Beirut was known as the Paris of the Middle East. When the French took over control of the region from the Ottoman Empire after World War I, there was something of a renaissance in culture, architecture, tourism, finance.
Yeah, and literature. So one of the reasons that I was in Beirut in 2005, I was an undergrad, I was majoring in Near Eastern Studies, and I became really interested in Lebanese literature. You know, Lebanon and Beirut especially was always a kind of literary hub of the Middle East. You'd have Beirut, you'd have Baghdad, you'd have Cairo were kind of the three places where you had a ton of publishers, a ton of authors, kind of in dialogue with each other. And then during the civil war in Lebanon, this group of authors that have been studied a little bit called the Beirut Decentrists arose that were mainly women writing about their own experiences. And it was this really cool group of artists that I became really interested in. And that was what brought me there in 2005. So I think it's really important to emphasize that even during times that are perceived as its darkest hours, you know, during the depths of the Civil War, Beirut has always still been host to an amazing cultural scene and, you know, very cosmopolitan cultural scene too. And it's famously a city where anybody crosses paths and people are coming and people are going, journalists and students, et cetera.
You know, back in the early 1990s, George H.W. Bush had a nickname for Portland, Oregon. He called the city Little Beirut. I guess he considered it ungovernable or something.
I mean, I think that it's obviously insulting, an awful, weird characterization from him, and definitely like a racist one too. But the idea of Beirut as ungovernable is actually like not all that far off in its current situation. I mean, right now, you know, you have a city that's shattered by this enormous bomb blast kind of brought on by governmental neglect, by the fact that it has not been governed, and an uprising in the streets again. I mean, my book is about an uprising in 2005 after an explosion, and there's been another explosion and there is another uprising. And this one is different fundamentally in almost every way from the one that I write about in 2005, but it's a cycle that has continued there.
Well, let's have a reading right now from Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions.
Okay, so it starts off with kind of an overhead bird's eye shot of the peninsula that Beirut is on. This kind of rocky peninsula with a plane from Middle Eastern Airlines coming in. And I begin the book with a line, "Memory is tricky business. The things you remember often are the most vivid. Their neural paths are worn deep in your brain. They're also the most treacherous. Each time you recall a memory, it's rewritten the moment you think of it. It is that rewriting that you remember the next time. A copy of a copy of a copy. Inconsistencies creep in, creating new ways through the story or obscuring older roads." So this is my first time writing kind of a memoir, I've written autobio before in short form, but writing something this big, you're kind of wrestling with the issue of consistency, memory. And that was a problem that I really went into the book wrestling with. And so starting off with that seemed to set the tone for it.
So there have been some studies done on memory at Stanford University, where you teach comics. There's a Center for Law and Biosciences. And a few years ago, they held a law and memory conference where subjects like the reliability of witness testimony were discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that was very much on my mind when I was writing this. And I think is something that kind of anybody who tries to write memoir wrestles with or should wrestle with, is this idea that the more often you return to an event, that event is kind of reframed in that reframing. It's almost like a copy machine, copying something over and over again. And, you know, a bug spot that gets on the screen like ends up in the subsequent copies. And it's a powerful idea in terms of therapy, actually, because, you know, you can kind of force people to deal with trauma in a more benign setting or using medications with a therapist and make that memory that they keep going to kind of copied in a better way so that when they return to it, those feelings are removed. But also, I mean, the book is about a personal state that I was in that was very traumatic, and also in which I sort of became an unreliable narrator of my own experience. And I have a diary from the time that veers in and out of focus and obsession, handwriting style. I kept a blog that was outward facing, where I was telling people what was going on outside so that they weren't worrying about me. And to actually write the book, I had to take the diary, which I stopped writing dates in at a certain point, and match it up with the online blog that I dug up many years later to be able to figure out what was happening when. And then talking to friends who had experienced it as well. I mean, I was sort of in a dissociative state. And so trying to reconstruct a memoir, a book from that, was difficult. And it made me very aware of the power of memory to sort of shape its own narrative.
Journaling and diaries play an important role in your story, not just your own diary, but also the journals that your mom started for you when you were a kid.
Yeah, it's funny. I have these, I think because she really wanted us to kind of keep our childhood with us, and recognized because of her own childhood traveling around how special it was. My mom made us keep diaries when we were kids, and she would actually write in them as the diary and ask us questions. So to a child, it appeared as if the diary was kind of writing to us and asking us what we were doing and asking us for more. And I mean, looking back on it in a certain way, it probably helped develop like storytelling skills and all these things that have helped me as an artist. And it's a practice that I've kept up inconsistently throughout my life. I'll suddenly start journaling again, and then I'll drop off from it. And I hadn't done it for a while before I started again, and when I went to Beirut. And I think something about the experience of it made me realize that it would be this important document going in. And so I kept scrupulous notes, even as my sort of self was fragmenting and everything around me was getting chaotic.
Yeah, there are some conversations you replay in the book, Spring Rain, conversations you had with your mom about your family, the mental health history, and you come back to this phrase, it runs in families. And yeah, if somebody is going to have issues with their mental health, say bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, it's really common for the symptoms to start emerging right around the undergraduate years, the late teens, the early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because of that, so my mom kind of grew up in not only in all these different places, but she also grew up with a mother who was an astonishingly talented artist. She was a sculptor and made these wonderful stone busts, one of which we have in my house that I grew up in. But she also suffered from bipolar disorder, and she was treated with electroshock therapy and also with medication. So she grew up with this as part of her life and had talked about it to us a lot as kids. And so we grew up with this idea that it was a possibility. And I think that having that hang over you in a period of crisis like that made me think about it a lot. I mean, it's something that I still think about a lot. It's an ongoing struggle in my life. And the role of family, both as a vector for something like this, but also as a support system, is something that I think about a lot.
And a major part of the story is about your attempt to recount an incident of emotional trauma from your high school years. It's almost the MacGuffin in the story.
Yeah, it is. I like to leave a couple paths of reading, ways to read stories as I write. And that's one of them. It's hard. It's a little hard for me to talk about, honestly, because it's a traumatic experience, but it forms a, one of the things that has been interesting for me in my life is the consideration of the way that trauma echoes, especially in memory. And so this incident in my youth of borderline abuse from a teacher, the way in which it then echoed into the breakdown that I had several years later in Beirut, and then the way in which that breakdown then echoed throughout my subsequent life is kind of the theme of the book in a certain way. I mean, I come back to the city two times towards the end of the book, and in the last third, I return to live again there in 2011 with my then girlfriend, now wife. And then I returned again in 2017 for an academic conference, seeing friends, et cetera, both times. And trying to use the framing of the returns to the city as metaphor almost for the way in which events like that echo in your life, and in the way that revisiting them is the way that you come to grips with them and fashion them into something that's useful to you instead of something that just hurts.
Well, I'm hesitant to use the word confessional, but there's not many details that you leave out of your story. At times, you're quite literally naked on the page.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of difficult for me, honestly. And also, there's a certain level of feelings of guilt of like dragging other people's stories along with me, you know? Like, I think that there's a very justified perception of especially male memoirists in comics who write about their sex lives that you can kind of like tell the stories of your partners without their consent, and that can be like this damaging thing. And I think that that's important and valid. And so it was a tough thing for me to do, but it was just kind of for that reason. It wasn't because I was embarrassed or anything. I mean, this story has kind of been around with me and like haunting me for long enough that I don't really have like embarrassment about it anymore.
It's almost a given that college students out on their own for the first time are going to exhibit poor judgment. You and your fellow students at the American University were no exception. This is a time for relationship drama, for finding the limits of your sexuality, maybe for testing tolerances for alcohol and drugs.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. At its heart, it's a memoir about going abroad in college. So it has those elements to it. At the same time, I was, you know, very aware of the fact that I'm a white American cis man, pretty straight, presenting like I've got a wife and kids, writing about sometimes, you know, communities and places that I'm can kind of be seen as a tourist in, like either a country or a community. So I tried to be as careful about that as I could while also showing the truth of those poor decisions, to like tell the story of a group of young people that are Americans abroad, and Americans abroad are ugly sometimes. But one of the amazing things about Beirut, actually, and a thing that makes me love it so much as a place, is that it's a very welcoming place to outsiders. The Lebanese people were forced by the trauma of their civil war into such a huge diaspora. I mean, it existed before the civil war, but the civil war kicked the Lebanese diaspora into high drive. And so you have kids that grew up in Australia, you have kids that grew up in England, wherever, and they move back for college or for business or to see their cousins or whatever. And that's just the Lebanese. And then you have foreign students and journalists everywhere. And so everybody kind of mixes. And, you know, there's other places I've been, like Dakar or you know, Cairo even, where the like foreigner community is much more separate than in Beirut. And one of the amazing things is how mixed up everything is there. So figuring out a way to tell that and be truthful while trying not to step on any toes. And I don't know, it's a balancing act.
Yeah, I think some readers of Spring Rain would be surprised to learn how prevalent queer culture and drug culture is in the Mideast.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe this is just the fact that I grew up kind of unattached to the hegemon as much as maybe I would have if I had grown up stateside. But people are sort of on the same age everywhere a lot more than you realize. Like nerd culture sort of transcends borders. Like you go anywhere and you like, if you find the like comics people, you can have a conversation about comics. And the same is true for so many subcultures. And to like imagine that it wouldn't be true for LGBTQ culture is short-sighted, but it is like, it's true that there's this perception of these places as, you know, like austere places ruled by like very conservative, dour people. And it's just not true. I mean, especially in a place like Lebanon where it's by law multicultural. I mean, there's no religious majority in Lebanon. But even in places, you know, like Egypt or Turkey or Iran, like there's kids, there's youth in all these places, and kids and youth are going to party, and there's going to be queer culture, there's going to be drug culture, there's going to be indie rock, there's going to be comics. And yeah, it's maybe easier to enter into those spaces in Beirut because the walls are a little more porous there. But yeah, it's all over the world.
Religious diversity is a big part of the landscape, both in Lebanon and in its neighbor Syria. And in both places, efforts to undermine that diversity have badly destabilized the region.
Yeah, I mean, in both places, you kind of, it's almost a classic story where you have the breakup of, you know, these big power structures that like held onto power by suppressing minority identity in Syria under the Ba'ath Party. And then the road to power is by exploiting any division, right? And so like in Lebanon, you have division and conflict sown not because X or Y sect needs to fight X or Y sect. It's because somebody sees it as a road to power. You saw it in the breakup of Yugoslavia. You see it, I mean, you could see it here, honestly. And this is sometimes I feel crazy because I feel like my vision is darker than everybody around me. But like a family on the streets of Aleppo eating like a nice dinner together in pre-Civil War times would never have guessed that in a few years their lives would be completely torn apart. And, you know, if you roll back the clock for us 6 months, we wouldn't even have guessed for this pandemic. And so, like, those divisions exist in those regions, but they're not the cause of kind of generations-old conflicts or anything like that. They're paths to power for warlords and people with bad intentions. And, you know, on the ground in Beirut, like the people that you're hanging out with in the bars and in the restaurants and in the nightclubs and in the art collectives, like don't give a shit. Like, sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this. Don't care where
I can bleep it.
Like what village, you know, your grandparents were from. Like there's like a perception often from the outside that these are age old and irreconcilable conflicts, but it's just, that's not the truth. They're fault lines that are exploitable, but we have fault lines too.
Well, the invasion and occupation of Iraq by George W. Bush back in the early aughts, I mean, that didn't help things. That was fresh in everybody's mind back in 2005 when you were first in Lebanon.
Yeah, I mean, as I get older, I view the breaking of Iraq more and more as this sort of turning point in history where you can trace the current instability in the region to and kind of the unraveling of this old political order that had endured there for a while and the rise of this new, pretty unstable era. What the Americans did in Iraq was kind of upset this regional center, this regional power. And so all the other regional powers, once that regional power was eliminated, began vying with each other. The ripples spread out from that. You know, this the breaking of Syria comes from that. You know, ISIS comes from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and it spreads across the border in a moment of vulnerability and then breaks that state. And you really just forget, because it's been a while, how incredibly poorly handled that imperial blunder was. I mean, just the fact that it didn't need to happen is enough, but that we really messed it up so bad is, you know, it haunts me really. And it haunts the region. And I'm not only blaming America in this. I mean, disaster has many mothers. As I said, you know, there's always a lot of people ready and willing to exploit the cracks that start to show when something big like that happens. And opportunism, you know, is what drives politics in a lot of places, like Lebanon and Syria and America.
You returned to Lebanon a couple of times, most recently just as Syria was about to erupt in civil war.
I returned there even more recently than that. So I returned there in 2011 and lived there for 4 or 5 months with my girlfriend. I was working for this comics magazine there called Samandal, that is this amazing comics collective that's been around forever and really shaped Arab comics in this fantastic way. So I was working as a guest editor with them and hanging out, and my wife was working there. And it was the summer of 2011, the spring and summer of 2011. So the what's come to be known as the Arab Spring, kind of regrettably, because I don't think spring is really the best word for it, had started that previous winter. You know, revolution really is contagious. You see this in history all the time. And in the region, it was amazing. There was all these old regimes that had endured for so long, kind of unchallengeable, that teetered and then suddenly were mortally wounded. In Egypt, the regime fell. You know, this is before the kind of return of the empire. This is the spring of 2011. And by that point, Syria is starting to descend into civil war. An uprising still, but you can kind of see the storm brewing. And that was when I was there in 2011. I then left in August. So before the civil war in Syria really started to kick off the following year, and then the subsequent refugee crisis spread to Lebanon. So then I returned actually in 2017. I had maintained, you know, ties through friendship and this magazine, Samandal, throughout this time, but I hadn't been back to Beirut. And so when I returned in 2017, it was the first time that I had seen the city kind of in the wake of this refugee crisis that had been caused by the Syrian civil war. I think will really go down in history as one of the most horrifying things to watch. And the fact that it all, you know, it was really one of the most social media savvy human tragedies to happen in a while. Every different faction had their own YouTube channel. It was a war that was fought both on social media and also on the ground.
So in the book, in Spring Rain, almost by accident, you became part of the largest public gathering in Beirut's history, at least up to that point.
Yeah, there's been bigger ones since then. But yeah, I mean, so the assassination of Rafik Hariri, this former prime minister, I mean, he was more than a prime minister. He was this incredibly rich man. He was the world's fourth richest politician when he was killed. And his company gobbled up a ton of downtown, war-torn Beirut real estate in the aftermath of the Civil War and rebuilt it as this sort of high-end luxury tourist zone catering to, you know, this like glitzy crowd. And a lot of people hate him for that. Other people love him. He was this lightning rod figure, and his assassination, at the time, the perception was that it was basically a hit that was ordered by Syria, which was the occupying, again, the Lebanese Civil War ended in the early 90s, but it kind of never really ended. Syria had marched into Beirut and even shelled Beirut at the end of the Lebanese Civil War, and was sort of the power broker that guaranteed the peace in the aftermath, and then basically kept the country as a client state. And it was pretty out in the open about it. There was like an office of Syrian army intelligence on the street of a friend of mine. There were Syrian troops in the country. And immediately in the aftermath of Hariri's assassination, people rose up and basically drove out the Syrian occupation. And it was a movement that seemed at first to be kind of something new and big, and then was immediately co-opted by entrenched sectarian interests and led to these dueling series of enormous protests and then enormous counter protests. And again, opportunistically, the political class of Lebanon kind of like retreated to their corners, and everybody then became very disheartened. And then years passed and the cycle repeated itself.
And so much of this happened during the one semester that you spent at the American University in Beirut. And there's a through line in the book, In Spring Rain, that follows the breakdown of society in Beirut and kind of the breakdown that you're having personally. And then in the end, the resilience that comes out of that.
Yeah, I mean, a resilience, but also not a resolution. And I think that that was really an important thing for me, because I think that it's false to present either personal narratives or revolutionary narratives that have endpoints, because it's always this ongoing process of, you know, if you're talking about mental health, there's no sort of blissful endpoint that you really ever reach. It's this constant negotiation with yourself and the situations that you're in and your inputs and outputs, and things get better and things get worse. And honestly, politics is kind of the same way. Like, you can decide to end something at some point and figure out that you've got a pretty good narrative out of it. But it's, you know, you end up with a resilience because of having experienced traumas and having experienced cycles of, you know, if you're a place, cycles of uprising, cycles of revolution, cycles of challenging authority. But very often those end in counter-revolution or old order reasserting itself, or, you know, personally, like, things coming apart again. And I think that it's trying to find a space for that in the book was as important to me as trying to also provide a hopeful narrative to it, that I do think that there is a way to view these things as being on an upswing while also living with the truth that it's never a battle that's won.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And I'm talking today with comics journalist Andy Warner. He's the author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. So, Andy, you've worked on various projects for some interesting clients. Right up there on the list of clients are some agencies at the United Nations.
I mean, I've done a ton of freelance work over my career, most of it focusing in some way around the idea of nonfiction comics. That's sort of what I do for a living, whether it's memoir or journalism or history. And in some cases, I do advocacy work too. So I worked with UNESCO and UNRWA to do these series that were trying to bring light to the refugee crisis, kind of flowing out of the Syrian civil war. I had done previous reporting work on that for Slate, for the NIB, for a few outlets. And they were trying to do this awareness raising campaign. And comics do really well online. So they commissioned me to do a comics journalist take on the refugee crisis for them.
And also some international diplomacy for other areas of the Middle East.
Yeah, it's funny. I was like an agent of weird American soft power under the Obama administration a couple times. I got sent out to Bahrain, like the State Department brought me out there as like a guest for a comics conference. There was like a big weird cutout of Barack Obama. And I like talked to people about comics and like American indie comics and weird stuff like that. And then I also was brought out again by like the State Department as a co-sponsor to Cairo Comics. Cairo Comics 2, it was the second iteration of this really awesome comics convention that this Egyptian comic collective called Tok Tok was putting on. And that was, I mean, an amazing experience. But it was also, I mean, it's interesting to be the smiley face on the empire, you know, because there's like a real history of the CIA like bankrolling literary publications and all sorts of under the table weird stuff. And, you know, I like don't hide my politics. So I just took the tickets and made the connection to Arab cartoonists that I met in Cairo and then proceeded to hire them for projects at the NIB. And it was a weird experience, especially the people that you deal with at the State Department, because they kind of reminded me a little bit of myself if I believed in American exceptionalism. But they all quit after, you know, Trump got into office. And I assume all those programs are long gone, because who's trying to be friendly to the Arab world using random American cartoonists anymore?
So did anybody from the CIA give you a friendly phone call before you left Berkeley for Bahrain?
No. I mean, but they're, you know, it's a weird thing. Like I remember at one point friends like in Beirut, you know, took my wife aside, who works for, I don't need to get into her job, but it's not for the CIA. But they were like, do you work for the CIA? Like, you can tell us. Like, you're just here all the time. Like, you speak French. Like, you can just tell us. So, I mean, those people are there. America is everywhere. Like, you're not going to kind of escape the fact that you're an agent of the empire. So you might as well take the free plane ticket. But Bahrain was pretty great. My handler there was the super nice guy. He was like a big comics fan. And his wife is the first female film director from Saudi Arabia, I think. She like won this award for this fantastic movie about this girl on this bicycle. And we like went to dinner at her house and, you know, he like drove me around, but he was like, you can't talk about the protests to the people. Like, they'll get arrested. It's not like you, like there's a security state here and they'll get like hauled off. So you shouldn't do that. And I was like, that's fair. I don't want to like endanger anybody. Yeah, I mean, it was weird.
So in addition to doing actual official diplomacy, you're sort of a diplomat for the whole sort of comics industry in terms of expanding the reach of comics. You've done some work for American Public Media, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I love nonfiction comics for everything it does. I mean, you can make it a little more like infographics and get really crunchy with data. You can make it more narrative driven and get really journalistic. There's so much out there in the world that it's really a challenge of just kind of carving away until you get the stories that you want. And so, yeah, I mean, I am a huge evangelist for comics in general, but especially nonfiction comics. In my teaching, I teach that to my students. And also, it's a way for younger cartoonists to get paid too, like writing. I think it's easier to get paid doing nonfiction essay type of stuff than it is to do fiction often. Yeah, I don't know. I love the form. I think that it's a great way of spreading information. I've worked for, in my freelance profession, I've done, like scientific interpretive work. I've done like political explainers. I've done a ton of different stuff because I think that it's really just an amazing tool that you can put to almost any use, just the conveying of real information.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your teaching. You've been working at two places as an instructor, Stanford University and the Animation Workshop in Denmark. It's got to be very different teaching at Stanford and teaching in Denmark.
Yeah, well, they're very different models. The Animation Workshop in Denmark is this really fascinating system where it's almost all guest teachers, basically. There's like a program runner per class. There's no real faculty. It's just these often professionals in the field, but sometimes teachers at other institutions that they bring out. So my course there is just a 2-week course every other year. And they like bring me out and I like stay there for 2 weeks and then teach it and then go home. And they do this with a ton of different cartoonists. I mean, Lucy Bellwood, like one of the fun things about it is that there's always two cartoonists there because there's two classes getting taught. So you're randomly paired in this dorm with another professional from the field. And it's super fun. You never know who you're going to end up living with for 2 weeks. But it's a great program. The Animation Workshop used to only teach animation. And then I think, it must be maybe 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, they started this comics program. And it's just fantastic. I mean, the students they're putting out are incredibly talented. And so that's that system. And then the Stanford program is a totally different class structure. It's all the students get together and it's over the course of 2 quarters. They all in this group put together this nonfiction comic. So they're all working together to write it, to draw it, to research it. And they actually put out a book each time it happens. Some of which, the last one that we just did, Flying Kites, was nominated for the Slate Cartoonist Studio Prize. So, I mean, these students like produce amazing kick-ass stuff. And yeah, it's a real honor to like help in any way that I can, really. And it's really fun to teach too. I mean, honestly, I find it very interesting because it makes me think about what I do and why I do it and the choices that I make. And also having to explain yourself to other people gives you a kind of deeper feeling for your craft and what you're doing.
Well, you've created a couple of more lighthearted books, comics journalism pieces. One of them is called Brief Histories of Everyday Objects. And the other one is This Land is My Land, a graphic history of big dreams, micronations, and other self-made states. You wrote that one with Sophie Louise Dam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sophie actually was a former student of mine at the Animation Workshop. So that's another, nice thing about teaching is sometimes you meet incredibly talented people who you end up collaborating on something with. But yeah, those are more examples of history. Again, it's all nonfiction for me, so it's all kind of the same like
stuff you're interested in
that I'm using. Yeah, exactly. I really love finding stories and cataloging them and finding ways to create themes and organize them. That's always been a hallmark of my career. And both those books are sort of in that vein of finding almost an organizational tool. In the case of Brief Histories, it was really short histories of the most boring things I could think of, like toilets and toothbrushes and beer cans and stuff like that.
And along the way, you're showing that there were disruptions and riots and things that formed these.
So it's like using a lens almost. So like take that idea and then I use that idea to like tell human history and tell stories about people and stories about things and the way that people cheat each other and copy each other and help each other and lift each other up and how people are bad to each other because of race or gender or sexuality or whatever, or good to each other. Like you can find a way to tell human stories using these organizational tools. And that's what underpins that book. It's also what underpins the Utopias book, because I was really thinking about utopias and radical reimaginings of society and things like that. This is all before the pandemic, ironically. But that governed that. And then actually my current project is called Commonplace Creatures. And again, it's another one of these books. This one is about domestication and animals and humans and, you know, dogs and horses and mosquitoes and things. I love to do that. I love to find a way to organize information and then start creating human stories out of that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and my guest today has been Andy Warner, author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. Andy, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Pleasure to talk to you, too.
For our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more?
You can go to my website, andywarnercomics.com. I am on Twitter at Andy Comics, but I don't really tweet much at all ever. Sorry to everybody who wants me to tweet like my publicists. But also, I mean, my books are available in stores. And I would very much encourage you to buy them from your local independent comic book store or bookstore, rather than our evil overlords. But, you know, do whatever you got to do.
Well, thanks again. And thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. Plus, a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Shop, 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 shop